This is an Old Testament book. It is in the section that we call the major prophets in the Christian Bible. It is not a Christian book. I mean, it is for us, but it wasn't written to us. The entire Bible is written for us. It's not all written to us. It is. There's a lot of it there that's for our benefit, to understand God's overall plan of progressive revelation in this world. We call it a major prophet only because of its size. And the other four major prophets are Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, and Daniel. The 12 so-called minor prophets follow them in our book. And those 12 minor prophets are only called minor in Christianity because of their size. And generally, they're quite short, except for Zechariah, which, as you know, is 14 chapters. And in the Christian Bible, all the prophets are collected together. In the Hebrew Bible, which is where these come from, and the Jews put this together long before Jesus was on the earth. The Hebrew Bible is called the Tanakh. The Tanakh. It's the same books arranged in a different way, written in Hebrew, and they're arranged in such a manner and categorized in such a manner that is quite a bit different than what we categorize them as in Christianity. The Hebrews referred to the book of Ezekiel as one of the latter prophets. They've divided out the former prophets and the latter prophets. And the term for prophets in Hebrew is Nevi'im, Nevi'im. Those are the prophets. Other later prophets are Isaiah, Jeremiah, and the 12 that we call the minor prophets. So the Jewish Talmud now, which is a big commentary on the Old Testament, and it's a bunch of discussions of Jewish people arguing over how many steps somebody takes on the Sabbath and so on. It is very extensive. I got a copy of the Talmud at home, and it's like 20 volumes, and it takes up this much space. It is interesting, though, to see the dialogue of people discussing these concepts. The Talmud arranges the books a little different in their discussion. They arrange these prophetic books in terms of their chronologies. So we have, in our Bible, we've got 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, and those are just one chronology. Okay, this happened in Israel, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and you can read those as a narrative of the period of the king, starting with David, or Saul, and then David, and Solomon, and on through the split when the Civil War happened, and a group of kings went to the north and came out of that, and a group of kings came out of the south. Well, the Jews in the Talmud now, not the Tanakh is the Bible, but this Talmud, they say, well, after the kings, it ought to be Jeremiah, because Jeremiah is concerned with the fall of Israel and the warning that doom is coming. The extent of his book is that doom is coming, and it comes, and it comes. And after it comes, he writes the book of Lamentations to talk about how bad it is, and it is bad. It is terrible how bad it is. And that's what Jeremiah writes. Ezekiel, they put right after him, because Ezekiel, for the first half of his book, is writing like Jeremiah. Things are coming. You guys are not paying attention to what God is saying. You're sinning greatly. And they're not listening to Jeremiah, and they're not listening to Ezekiel. But the last half of Ezekiel's book is one of consolation, a restoration of Israel. on into the millennial kingdom, and a detailed description of the millennial kingdom comes out of Ezekiel. So Ezekiel's sort of a transition between Jeremiah, which is all gloom and doom, to Ezekiel, part gloom and doom, and then part restoration. And then they put Isaiah after that, which is all restoration. Talk about the coming of the Messiah and the wonderful millennial kingdom and all the benefits that the Jews have for being the chosen people. I've put the order of the Jewish books in your notes, and I would say they call them the Tanakh. The Tanakh. And that comes from Torah, with a T, first five books of the Bible, Nevi'im, prophets, N, and Ketuvim, the writing. So T, N, K, Tanakh. That's why they call it the Tanakh. So the books are, you see the Torah there, which is also called the law, and I put down the names in Hebrew and then the English names. I have yet to understand why anybody calls these books by these English names. I don't know where the English names come from. I'm trying to find that out, and I can't find it out. I don't know why this happens. For example, Ezekiel is not this prophet's name. And when I mentioned that to my modern Hebrew teacher, she bristles. That's not his name. It's Yehezkel. Yehezkel. Where does Ezekiel come from? I have no idea where these names come from. The first book of the Bible is Bereshit. It's not Genesis. Did you ever wonder how language develops and how we get from one word that these people wrote? I mean, Ezekiel was written 2,500 years ago. English didn't come in until, what, 1,200 or so? 13? I don't know when Chaucer started writing, but A.D. So, you know, it's like 1,700 years after this book is written, people change the name. So, be that as it may, I put them both down there. See the Nevi'im, the prophets, the minor prophets. They call those a tristar. And the Ketuvim are the writings. And within the Ketuvim, you got the scrolls, the Megillot. And those are, you know, all the broad category of the writing. Anyway, that's the order of the books in the Hebrew Bible. And this is the Hebrew Bible. This is written by Jews, for Jews, to Jews. And it's important that we understand this because we, as the church, are comprised of both Jews and Gentiles, and we're set apart. We are not part of the nation Israel. We are the church. We have not replaced the nation Israel. We have been born again through the blood of the Lord Jesus, and we get that blessing from him. But Jews and Gentiles come into the church and God's program. The church is only an institution that lasts from the first Pentecost after Christ rose from the dead, or after he ascended, excuse me, until the rapture of the church. And then the church is gone. There's no more need for the church. The church goes to heaven. There's a marriage supper of the Lamb. And the wedding, the church is called the bride of Christ, is wed to her husband, the Messiah. That's the end of the church. It's not the end of salvation, but it's the end of that unit called the church. And why is the church made? Why are we here as the church? To make the Jews jealous so that they would want Jesus, their Messiah. That's it. Sounds like, oh, there's got to be more than that. No, that's what we're here for. Oh, you can talk about we spread the gospel and tell others about Christ. Yeah, but the fundamental reason for the church is to make the Jews jealous so that they'll want their Messiah. I want to talk to you now in an introduction to this book about the timing of this book. This is real important, so I'm going to go over the text that I put into your notes very carefully. My wife will edit it and clean it up a little bit. I can see some mistakes I made this morning when I read it again. There was a battle, and I mean a famous battle, at Carchemish. Carchemish was a city on the banks of the Euphrates. This battle changed the course of human history. Most history, the development of nations, the fall of nations, the change of boundaries, and so on, are the result of battles. I mean, our country was founded as the result of a battle to throw off the yoke of the Brits. Revolutionary War. The realignment of the countries in Europe was entirely different after the First World War than that what was there before. I mean, there was an enormous Austro-Hungarian Empire that disappeared, was broken up. The Eastern Bloc countries all changed their boundaries. So wars will change history, will take people off of leadership positions and put people into leadership positions. And it's important to know that. Now, this battle took place on the Euphrates River at Carchemish in 605 BC. The players were the Babylonians, the Assyrians, and the Egyptians. Now, the Assyrians had been chased out of their capital city, Nineveh, in 612 BC. They fled north to Haran. And you remember Haran, that's where Abraham came from. That's where he lived. That was his hometown. They fled up there. The Babylonians chased them out of there. Chased them down to Carchemish. In the meantime, the Assyrians make a political league with the Egyptians, and the pharaoh at the time was Necho, Pharaoh Necho. He wasn't all that wise. He made a bad deal. He made a league with the Assyrians, and he decided to go help his buddies at Carchemish when they were starting to fight the Babylonians. So he's going from Egypt now, he's going east, and he goes across the northern plains in Israel, and he gets to the place called Megiddo. The Judean king, Josiah, who was a wonderful king, this was not Josiah's battle, by the way. But he intervenes, and it's unclear from the text why he did. I don't understand. I can second guess maybe why he did it, but I don't know why he did it. He goes up north from Jerusalem to Megiddo. Now, Megiddo is a place that has had many, many battles. As a matter of fact, the last battle that is going to take place before the millennial kingdom is going to be there at the mountain of Megiddo. The mountain, the name for mountain in Hebrew is Har, and Megiddo, so you get Har-Megiddo. And people have turned that into an English word of Armageddon. It's not Armageddon, it's Har-Megiddo. It's the mountain of Megiddo, and it's the plains of Jezreel, where that mountain is, and Megiddo, that this last battle is going to take place, and where Josiah goes up to meet Necho. So Necho and his troops are going east across northern Israel, and Josiah goes up and starts to fight with them. I mean, it must have surprised Necho. The Israelis were doing well, but they lost their leader. Josiah took a couple of arrows in his chariot, and he died. He was dying right there. He said, get me off the battlefield. I'm dying. I'm done. And as I said, he was a wonderful king. So he dies. Necho then has the superior army because the Israelis lost their commander. When you lose the commander, you'll lose the prowess of the army to fight, unless they raise up somebody quickly, and they didn't. There wasn't one as strong as Josiah. So, Necho, he's basically waylaid here. You know, he's stopped in his tracks trying to get over and fight with the Assyrians against the Babylonians, and he can't do it. Josiah dies, the Israelis lose. Necho continues on over to Carchemish. Meanwhile, the Jews need a king. We don't have a king. So in the succession of kings of this day, you can see the same thing happen in politics today. There are family dynasties. One wants to get the other one in. Well, when you're king, you got a more absolute authority than, for example, the representative republic that we have here. So it's a little harder to get your son or your brother in. It wasn't back then. Josiah's son, Jehoahaz. Now, these names are going to be a little confusing. That's why I've written this out for you. And this is actually in 2 Chronicles and 2 Kings. Josiah's son, Jehoahaz, is made king. And Necho, at the end of the battle, goes back to Jerusalem. He's mad now. Hey, you guys caused me some casualties. You caused me problems. They lose the battle at Carchemish. The Babylonians win. But Necho's mad because the Jews under Josiah stopped him from coming, harmed his army, and just irritated him. So he goes down to Jerusalem, and he gets tribute money from Jehoahaz of 100 talents of silver. This is such a vast sum of money. And a talent of gold, that's like 100 pounds of gold. I mean, gold right now is $1,000 or $1,100 an ounce? This is talking about hundreds of pounds. I mean, he took a lot of money from them. He sets up a guy named Eliakim as the king. He takes Jehoahaz. He says, you're out of here. You're out of here. You know, he's so mad. He's so mad that he takes him back to Egypt. He changes Eliakim's name. This is something else these guys did. They would take the king, put a king in they wanted, that they thought would be complicit with their needs, and they change their name. So he changes his name to Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim. And he takes his brother Jehoahaz to Egypt. So he carts him off. Remember, Jehoahaz was the replacement that the Jews put in for Josiah that was killed. And this guy that they put in, he was evil, just evil. So the net result, though, of this battle of Carchemish, and this is a famous battle. I mean, it's written up in the military annals and all encyclopedias and everything. It caused the formal end to the political power of both Assyria and Egypt. Now, Egypt limped on for a while, but Egypt was an incredible world power, and so was Assyria. But the Babylonians just wiped them out. The Assyrians were gone. The Egyptians were there, but they limped on. They limped on. Babylon became the Gentile world empire. So along comes Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon after the Battle of Carchemish, and he decides to go to Jerusalem. He probably thought there was something there for him because Necho got a bunch of money. He figured, man, if Necho got all this money, I'm going there. So it results in him tying up fetters. Fetters are a particular kind of binding, and they tied up Jehoiakim, and they carried away the best of the best of the Israeli youth, one of which was Daniel the prophet and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Although for some reason their Babylonian names stick, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But that's not their names. And you'll notice they all have El somehow or I-L. That means they were all godly, God-fearing men. The temple was plundered. Now, this is 605 B.C. So the temple is plundered. Nebuchadnezzar is just having a field day here. He's taking anything he can. Jehoiakim submits to Nebuchadnezzar for 3 years as a vassal king, which means he's a puppet. In other words, he's going to do whatever Nebuchadnezzar wants. So Nebuchadnezzar thinks, my king's gone over there. They're sitting on the throne over there in Jerusalem, so he's going to do what I want. But Jehoiakim revolted. He decides after a few years, nah, I'm not going to do this. I don't like this anymore. So he goes to Egypt. Now remember, Egypt has been almost destroyed, but they're still alive. The Syrians were destroyed, but Egypt is limping along. He goes over to Egypt and he says, help me out. Make an alliance with me against these Babylonians. He says, okay, you know, I'll make an alliance with you. But they had no political power anymore. They had no military power. They couldn't do anything, and it was a stupid thing for him to do. Throughout the biblical text, you see these bad kings relying on their own political prowess instead of God. And that's the story of these kings. They were evil in many cases, and they would not turn to God. So God says, okay, I'm going to bring these calamities on you. And it's as if people think that God is not in control in this world, and things just happen. No, God is in complete control, and the morality of a nation is what God judges. We're ripe here. I mean, we are ripe here. Do you have any idea how many millions and millions of babies women have aborted? Millions. And now these videos that are coming out are showing in detail what they're doing. I hope that's enough to push people away from Planned Parenthood and get the government to stop giving them money. And then the Supreme Court decided recently that the sodomites can marry, homosexuals can marry. What craziness is going on? God will judge this. God will judge this. He's judged these people. And this is a perfect example for us to see. The Apostle Paul talks about one of the reasons for us paying attention to the Tanakh, the Old Testament, is for the examples. He said, the examples are what is important. Look what happened. Look what they did. Look what they did. Well, anyway, this Jehoiakim revolts. Nebuchadnezzar comes back. He takes him to Babylon, but he released him later on. He liked the guy, so he releases him, and somehow this guy comes back to Jerusalem. We don't know how he came back to Jerusalem, but that's where the text says he died. But Jeremiah the prophet just despised this guy. He hated him because he was so evil and wicked. So that was the first siege of Babylon. Daniel gets taken away and his three friends and a whole host of others. And Nebuchadnezzar severely harms the temple and takes a lot of things from it. Well, when Jehoiakim died in 598 BC, his son, Jehoiachin, succeeded him on the throne. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had sent troops into Jerusalem late into Jehoiakim's reign, okay? Because he kept resisting, as we saw, and he tried to make a league with Egypt, which really angered Nebuchadnezzar because he thought he made an end to all that at Carchemish. But the Jews rose up against him again. So Nebuchadnezzar comes back to Jerusalem in 597 B.C. By this time, though, as we saw, Jehoiakim had died. Jehoiachin had taken the throne up. Throughout the biblical text, he is also referred to by two other names, Jeconiah and Coniah. So all three of those names appear in the biblical text. Jehoiachin, Jeconiah, and Coniah had replaced him as the king. So the Babylonians dethrone him, 597 B.C., and they take away not just him to Babylon, but his wives, his mother, his princes, his servants, and many other people, including Ezekiel. So this is what is important in our book here. Daniel got carted off to Babylon in 605 B.C., and his friends, Ezekiel in 597 B.C. So Ezekiel begins to prophesy a few years later that I'll look at in a moment. The Babylonian king sets up Jehoiachin's uncle, Mattaniah, as the king. So can you imagine this? I want you to be king. Yeah, it'd be okay, you're close. They wanted to pick a king that would be at least palatable to the population because the king was going to have to be, if not admired, at least followed. So they wanted a king that the people were going to sort of accept, and so they picked Jehoiachin's uncle, Mattaniah. Nebuchadnezzar changes this guy's name to Zedekiah, and he makes him another vassal king. In other words, you're a puppet here. You just do what I tell you. Just do what I tell you. And for several years, he obeyed. Then the people start rising up. You know, they got a few years of peace. The Babylonians were not there anymore, and the people start rising up. And they get this, what we call the nationalists, you know, the people that want the nation Israel, so on. They don't like the idea that Zedekiah's got to be beholden to Nebuchadnezzar. So this king rebels. Very foolish thing to do. Very, very foolish thing to do. And the whole time this is happening, Jeremiah is prophesying, don't do this. It's not just that you rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. Stop sinning. Stop sinning. Zedekiah would not pay attention to Jeremiah. We had him jailed and exiled and all kinds of things. It was terrible. Meanwhile, Ezekiel is over in Babylon now as a captive. He's prophesying to the Jews there, but they're getting messages back to Jerusalem. And they're both imploring the Jews to start following God and forget about this rebellion stuff. Don't do this. It is God that brought these calamities on you in the first place. Don't do it. So he doesn't listen. He listens to his false prophets, and they tell him, don't worry about it, man. You got it made. You know, there's no Babylonians coming, and you don't have to worry about it. It's all over. So in 588 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar again comes over. He comes over, he besieges Jerusalem. He lifted the siege just a little because this league that they had made, the Jews had made with the Egyptians, did find some response from the Egyptians, and they came over to help, but not against Nebuchadnezzar. There's nothing they can do. And Nebuchadnezzar just wipes them out. And the Babylonians easily defeat Egypt. So they come back to their siege of Jerusalem. Let's get back at getting back at it here. We got to punish Zedekiah. He's not doing what we wanted. So finally, the Babylonians break through the wall. And on January the 16th of 586 B.C., which is the fourth month of Zedekiah's 11th year on the throne, the siege breaks through the wall and everybody scatters, okay? The soldiers flee, Zedekiah flees, but it doesn't work because Nebuchadnezzar's army has surrounded the old city of Jerusalem, and he catches them all. They kill them all. They take, the soldiers bring Zedekiah to Nebuchadnezzar's camp at Ribla on the Orontes River. It's north of Damascus. And what he does, the first thing he does is he kills Zedekiah's sons in front of him. And he wants them to see there are no heirs to this throne. And then he puts him in shackles and he blinds him, which makes any more rebellion impossible. And he carts him off to Babylon. Now, Zedekiah died in Babylon. And he was not well respected there. He was tolerated. Can you imagine that, seeing your sons die in front of you and then have your eyes put out? That's what happened. All this happened because they would not trust God. They believed false prophets, and they did not follow God. It's not happenstance. God is controlling everything. This book of Ezekiel was actually written by Ezekiel, Yechezkel. His name means God will strengthen, or God strengthens. And as we go through this book, we're going to see a whole host of things that God does for him and to him to strengthen him to keep prophesying. Now, bear in mind now, he's a prisoner of war, and he's writing things to the Jews about their impending destruction, which happened in 586 BC, because he's there, you know, 11 years earlier, in the enemy camp. So there's a, you know... This is kind of a queasy situation to be in. He needed to be strengthened. Ezekiel is not mentioned in any Old Testament book. He is alluded to in the New Testament, principally with the visions of John the Apostle on the Isle of Patmos that he has in the throne room of God in Revelation chapter 4 and chapter 5. Similar visions are coming from Ezekiel of the cherubim. The cherubim are the highest order of the celestial beings. He sees the cherubim. He sees the cherubim lifting God the Father out of the temple at the destruction. God decided he would not be a part to sin, and explains exactly to Ezekiel why he's leaving. We'll see what they're doing, what they were doing. The sin that was carrying on is heinous. What we see today in this country through the media, through these court decisions and all this other stuff, is only the tip of the iceberg. We don't see what they're really doing. Now, some of these videos are coming out with pretty graphic pictures of what Planned Parenthood is doing. So we get additional insight into it, but we still don't know what they're doing. God takes us into the temple to show the heinous idolatry that the Jews are committing against him. So we're going to see this. And Ezekiel was a priest. And a priest can only become one at the age of 30 years. His father's name was Buzi, and that in Hebrew means contempt. And as a priest, he was of the Zadok family. There's some interesting positioning of the family of Zadok that we're going to see later on in this book. as they have a prominent role in the millennial kingdom on the mountain of Israel, the Temple Mount of Israel. It's the highest mountain in the world after the tribulation. So Ezekiel was a priest. We don't have any evidence that he performed any priestly activities in Jerusalem before he got carted away. But his background is so extensive to be able to understand what God was telling him and to be able to reduce it to writing about priestly traditions and language, ideology, as well as an intimate understanding of the Temple of Jerusalem. Because what Ezekiel is going to be given in the latter half of this book is detailed, and I mean detailed, instructions about the construction and operation of the millennial temple. The temple that's going to be in Jerusalem during the millennial kingdom. Matter of fact, that is one of the reasons why the Jews had such a hard time putting Ezekiel in the Old Testament. They just kept trying to square it with the Mosaic Law and square it with the temple that had been in Jerusalem, and it didn't match up. It was a lot of fights that they went through to get that book in their Bible. This is why, because it's about a different period. And the sacrifices are coming back, but they're different, a different kind of sacrifice. This is all ceremonial. The festivals are coming back, but not all of them. He was born in 627 BC. He was married. He had his own home. And the elders within the nation Israel in Babylon would come and confer with him on a regular basis. Jeremiah was different. Jeremiah remained unmarried. And the two of them, insofar as we know, didn't know each other. Ezekiel had a wife that he loved dearly, called her the desire of his eyes, and she suddenly died 9 years after he was there. And it was about 4 years after he entered the prophetic ministry, because he didn't enter it right away getting over there. He wasn't called immediately. We're going to see that in chapter 24. He didn't hardly have any interruptions with his prophecy, and he continued almost regularly until he was 52. We don't know exactly when he died. We don't know about the end of his ministry. We know that he was a contemporary of Jeremiah, as I said, but he doesn't mention him anywhere in the book, and they were both saying the same thing, at least throughout the first half of Ezekiel's book. God gives Ezekiel some incredible personal experiences to strengthen him and bring that message with some degree of force through these illustrations to the Jews. He wasn't just dropping it out there. He was acting out some of these things in a manner that God had given him so that these people that were the captives in Babylon would understand in a very graphic sense what God was saying through him. He had him shut himself up in his home for a while, not talk to anybody. He had him bind himself, tie himself up. He had him made dumb. God says, okay, you're not going to be able to speak now. He had him lie on his right side at one point and then on his left side for 430 days. In other words, don't stand up. So that's way over a year. And he had him make some bread. I don't want to disgust you now. I'll wait until we get into that chapter, chapter 4. But he had him make bread in a very, very unclean manner. These were all symbols to Israel. More so than just telling them, he was showing them what they did. He had to shave his head and his beard. He loved his wife, and he was told he couldn't mourn for her. You can't mourn for your wife, so he didn't. He lost his speech. He was just a sign to the nation Israel. Some of the commentators that don't know God and have written about him, including Jewish commentators. Just look at some of the things that Ezekiel didn't figure. Well, he was just crazy. How did that book ever get in the Bible? I mean, who ever heard of somebody lying on their side for 430 days? I mean, why is he doing that? Or where did these crazy visions come from? This is God's book. This is not Ezekiel's book. This is God telling the Jews, directing their behavior through this prophet. There's an ongoing message that comes from God, and people ignore it. We can make a pretty strong comparison to Ezekiel's condition and isolation to the Apostle John. Now, Ezekiel was carted away to Babylon in 597 BC in the second siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. Apostle John, for preaching the word of God, was placed on a craggy, remote island in the Aegean Sea, which is between Greece and Turkey, called Patmos. It was a penal colony for the Romans, and it was the Roman Emperor Domitian that had him put over there. So they're both isolated, they both have nothing to speak of, and they're both getting these incredible visions from God about what's going to happen. What's going to happen? These two books are tied together quite well. Many of Ezekiel's prophecies can be dated to the specific day that they came, and his earlier prophecies were not well received because they were telling the Jews to stop sinning. Sin is lodged deep in the heart of a human being and does not want to come out. Does not want to come out. The only thing that is going to get rid of sin is the slaughter of most of the people in this world at the Great Tribulation. That will make an end of sin. You know, and you can see what God does, and that's what it takes, because people will not stop. They just will not stop. So he had a very difficult time in the first part of his ministry. Over time, though, they accepted what he was saying, and that nation got purged for a time of their idolatry. I mean, there was just huge spiritual decline in Israel at that time. And he clearly saw that judgment was coming and tried to tell them, man, Nebuchadnezzar is going to come back. He's going to do it. He is going to do it. And after the judgment came, Ezekiel started getting visions about consolation, consoling the Jews that they had a future. Just like Zechariah. After the Babylonian captivity was over and the Medes took over from the Babylons, and the Medes said, man, you guys can go back. You know, we got no beef with you. Go on back. Zechariah starts prophesying about a future for the Jews. A future. Well, that's what the last half of this book is like. And we're going to see what these passages say in Ezekiel about the restoration of that nation today. Chapter 20 talks about them being back today, in our day. It says that they come back after a persecution and before a persecution. Well, the persecution that caused them to come back, that generated world sympathy, was the Nazi Holocaust. It was a slam dunk getting that process through the United Nations to give them that country back, because world sympathy was at an all-time high for them. The persecution that's coming is under the Antichrist. At the middle of the Great Tribulation, the Antichrist goes into the Holy of Holies, where an image of himself has been set up by this false prophet the worldwide leader of all the apostate religions. And Satan brings that image alive, and the Antichrist declares himself God and immediately starts persecuting the Jews. The biggest persecution of the Jews that has ever happened will happen then, all because they would not turn to their Messiah. Now, I put a chart in your notes there where it shows actually the month and the day and then the year of the captivity under Jehoiachin. So each one of the prophecies in the sections of the book there show you what we're going to be looking at as we go through this book. Ezekiel never returned to Israel. He died in Babylon, and there's a Jewish philosopher and Bible commentator that lived in Portugal in the 1400s. He's a guy just like Maimonides was. His name is Isaac Abravanel. And he wrote a lot of commentaries on the Bible, but he stuck pretty close to the prophets. And he cites a report by somebody that was a contemporary to him called Benjamin of Tudela. The guy was an explorer, and he claimed in the 1400s to have seen Ezekiel's grave in Babylon. And at that time, there wasn't any dispute about it. And he said it was within a half mile of a synagogue in Babylon, between the rivers Euphrates and Kebar. And he said the tomb is located way in the back of the synagogue of also Ananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the three friends of Daniel that were taken in 605. Now, today, there is a tomb over there that the Jews claim is the tomb of Ezekiel. And the Muslims, though, claim it's a tomb of some Muslim named Duhul Kifil, or Kifil. Saddam Hussein, when he was alive, protected that site as a holy site to Islam. So I don't know if that's Ezekiel's grave or not. But I know in the 1400s, the eyewitness account said the grave was there. It was behind the synagogue, and it was valid. I just want to briefly look at the outline. It's a very extensive outline. I just want to touch on a few things here. We're going to start into this next week. I got a couple other introductory quick topics to touch on next week, and then we'll start into the book formally. Right away, Ezekiel's got a huge vision, first chapter. It's the cherubim of God and all the activities associated with that, what he sees and what he relates. And it's in great detail. This is greater detail than Revelation 4 and 5, but it's the same cherubim. Then Ezekiel sees the Christ of God. He sees the second person of the Trinity. And he begins to employ these visual aids to help us understand the other side. And it's interesting. You can describe things, but it's still hard to understand. It's hard to see. Because you can only describe things that are indescribable by using similes and metaphors. You know, saying something like, well, it's like this. But it's not that. It's like it. Because you can't describe something that's indescribable. You can't do it. So Ezekiel's prophecies and imagery is fascinating because he's doing such a good job of describing the indescribable. And he's describing this through the spiritual decline of that nation. They were just disgusting what they were doing. I mean, it really was bad, not just a little bad, but really bad. He preaches his first sermon about God's judgment, and it's warning these people. He said, you've got to pay attention, and all they did was fight him. All they did was fight him. He's got a vision of Jerusalem's sin. And he gets this vision by God says, okay, I'm going to take you from here. I'm going to put you over into the temple. I want you to see what they're doing behind these doors. Oh, he says, I'm going to show you greater sins than these. And he bores down into that temple and he shows him even worse things. He sees the glory of God depart from the temple in Jerusalem, and he describes it in great detail. Then his ministry becomes what he calls the watchman on the wall. He became the trumpet to blast out the truth and get people to understand what it was that he was saying. He condemns the false prophet. He condemns the idol worshipers. And he has these interesting allegories, one of which is he depicts Israel as God's unfaithful wife. It's interesting. You know, God uses these metaphors. He calls Israel the wife of Jehovah. The church is the bride of Christ. We're married to Christ. And then, you know, in a marriage relationship, it's the closest relationship you can have on this earth. And that's what God wants. So therefore, he uses this imagery to describe what that relationship is. And the bride of the wife of Jehovah, there's a whole series of parables and descriptions of the punishment that they're going to go through. And he warns Israel of the consequences of their sins. What's important for us today is to see how God works. God is only going to let the sins of this country go on for so long before there's a judgment. Before there's a judgment, he details the sins and he compares Jerusalem and Samaria, which is the southern part of Jerusalem. You know, what they call the West Bank today, I mean, that's a nasty term because it's really Judea and Samaria. Well, he's comparing Samaria and Judea or Jerusalem to two prostitutes. Two prostitutes. And he describes what their activities are. He gives a whole host of signs to Israel, one of which is a funeral sign. Tell them what's going to happen to them. Then he goes on to make prophecies of the end result of the nations around Israel's relationship to them. If they've harmed them, if they've helped them. And each one of those relationships ends somehow, either with a restoration or an elimination. And he goes through Philistine, Tyre, Ammon, Tyre. I mean, it's huge. He describes in detail in the 28th chapter the fall of the anointed cherub, Halal, who became Satan. I know people call him Lucifer, but that's the Latin term for Halal that Jerome wrote in the Vulgate when he translated the Bible into Latin, I don't know, 285 or so B.C., or A.D., and their prophecy against Zidon and Egypt. And he finally has pity on Egypt. It's interesting. But it'd be interesting. I think you'll find this book to be really interesting because God shows us who is going to survive, who he's going to bless, that have had a relationship with Israel of some sort. And then he talks about the relationship of the leaders to Israel before the fall and after the fall of Jerusalem. And he talks about the false shepherds, and he talks about the good shepherds. So we get this information to help us in our discernment of listening to people tell us what God has said. And Ezekiel goes into great detail about who's a false shepherd and who is not a false shepherd. And it's interesting. It is very, very interesting. It could be with the massive apostasy that we have going on in Christendom. Maybe that's why people don't want to read Ezekiel. He's too forthcoming about who's a false shepherd. He talks about Edom's destruction and Israel's salvation. Now, Edom, if you remember, is modern-day Lebanon. And Lebanon has been relatively friendly to the Jews. He talks about then the salvation of Israel, and there is a salvation coming to the nation Israel through into the millennial kingdom. And he gives a lot of interesting discussions through illustrations about mergers and acquisitions and then attacks. He's going to talk, as we have done here, in great detail about the future invasion of Israel by the Russians, led by a man whose title is Gog, G-O-G, and all the nations surrounding Israel. He's going to talk about the annihilation of those nations and the supremacy of Israel that God is supporting. And then you get into chapter 40, and chapter 40 on to 48 is the glories of the millennial kingdom. The temple, the size, the practices, everything related to it. And it is in great detail. So I will have some diagrams for you and some text about its size and how worship is going to be conducted. And the reason that's important for us is because we're going to be there. We are going to be part of this in Jerusalem. We're going to go there at least once a year. Feast of Tabernacles. The Gentiles are commanded to go there once a year. But we'd probably be there more than that. That's the world government now. It's going to be Jesus on the throne running the government from Jerusalem. What a book, huh? What a book. It's just amazing to me that all of this is in this book. And so many people just won't read it, won't understand it, push it away. Shall we pray?